Hello and welcome to National League Town, Mets fandom, Mets history, Mets life, with Long Island's own Greg Prince and Jeff Heisen. Hey, Greg.
Greetings from 1977, Jeff, or whatever year it is that the Mets are just wallowing after making trades. No, only kidding. Things are great.
On today's show, we remember Eddie Bresud, but first, we want to follow up last week's conversation, and we thank you for your positive response to what was a very difficult conversation on the show called Swap Meet. I want to relate to you a follow-up text chain that I had with my brother. It was the night of the show, and he texted to me, "I get it, but I'm still mad because I just want to be entertained." And I said, "They're certainly not going to be entertaining now." He said, "I want to put on the game, look for players that I recognize, and hope that they can win. None of that's going to happen the rest of the year." And I said, "That's true, except they weren't winning anyway. So nothing was going to get better other than you'd see some players you recognized." He said, "But it won't be entertaining." And I said, "But maybe it'll be entertaining in 2 years, if not next year." And he said, "But you don't know that. Remember, you said on the show, you don't get a banner for having the number one farm system as declared by Baseball America." And I said, "I was right about that. That's true. The chances of the Mets improving are better with Acuna and with Gilbert and with the other players than with the players they had." He said, "I understand. I get it. But I'm still mad because I just want to be entertained." And after the first six games in the post-trade era, Greg, it certainly hasn't been entertaining.
No, "Let Me Entertain You" is not the theme song of the 2023 Mets. I would contend it was never the theme song of the 2023 Mets. So when we were watching the Mets before they decided to make these trades, I wasn't entertained. You weren't entertained. I doubt your brother was entertained. It's interesting trying to wrap one's arms and head and all those things we wrap around events like these. And I think it's doubly interesting because you had this interchange with your brother the same time, more or less. I was having one with my sister, who is not a baseball fan, is sympathetic to the Met cause for my good, basically. And she doesn't pick up on too many things that go on in the Mets world, but she somehow managed to hear about this. She managed to hear that the Mets had made a bunch of trades and that Steve Cohen was somehow involved in making them happen, and asked me to, in so many words, Mets-splain it to her. I think I was trying to do it in a way that one would explain to somebody who doesn't really care. So you're not going to be throwing names around that she's not familiar with. But I tried. It was a valuable exercise because it gave me a chance to step back and try to make sense of what has happened. And, you know, I explained the idea behind it that, you know, it's not "Let Me Entertain You." It's staying alive, because we're all going to need to be staying alive until 2025 or 2026 to see what these trades are about. But, you know, I said to her, "Listen, they couldn't have done this without Steve Cohen, A, deciding this wasn't working," this being the 2023 Mets and what lay ahead for 2024, "and B, his willingness to eat a lot of money that no other owner would have eaten, to have what amounted to, as we talked about last week, his own private draft." And I'm not sure that she got it in terms of, you know, you give up players who are maybe going to help you win some more games now for the idea that later on things will be much better because they weren't that good now. And I understand that, because it's a bit of a tough concept if you're just looking at, well, you watch your team, don't you want them to win every game? And I found myself thinking, I'm not sure either. And I have gone back and forth over the past week, not at all helped along by the way the Mets have played. And I've gone back and forth between, yeah, you know what, this was a forward-looking, bold move, and we're fortunate that we have an owner with the resources to make it happen, to understand that running in place is not the place to be, and that if we all are sort of patient and have good faith and decide that this deserves good faith, that if things work out, we'll be better off for it in the long term because we are long-term fans. And I juxtapose that with, is this all just another load of BS? Is this just all a shinier version of we're going to get the guys we got for Tom Seaver and Dave Kingman low those many trade deadlines ago, and we might root for them, but it's not going to get us anywhere. And that's a very simplistic comparison, but we've been through these sorts of trade deadlines before, and these sorts of overhauls. The two things I would say that feel different are one that I really think some thought was put into this, that they made the best of not just the best of a bad situation, but they were determined to make good out of a not good situation. And the other thing is, I think that these are people who, and by people, I mean Steve Cohen, Alex Cohen, we'll throw Billy Epler in there because he's working for them, and whoever else is helping to make these decisions and scout these players, that this is all part of a larger view of what the Mets can be, as opposed to we're just getting rid of some contracts here. Again, if this had been, Pham and Canna and Robertson going, and you're just getting whoever you got for them, no matter how good those packages or individuals might have been, it wouldn't really be all that different from any other year where a team not really in it kind of gives up. It was Verlander and Scherzer and the money that was eaten and the haul that came back that makes this a real pivot point. And it doesn't help when you're losing three in a row to Kansas City and three in a row to Baltimore, and you're barely in any of those games. And I can't blame anybody who doesn't really want to watch them, who says this isn't entertaining. Now, again, did we think the 2023 Mets were entertaining, to use your brother's word, before all of this? No, we came on every week, or at least the weeks where we decided to talk about it, and said, this team's tough to watch, and this team is not competing, and this team can't get out of its own way. I guess the main difference is that two out of those five games of every week, six games a week, I suppose, but you know what I mean, two out of every times through the rotation, we at least figured, well, Scherzer's going tonight. We know Scherzer's had his problems, but he's still Scherzer. Verlander's going tonight. Verlander seems to be getting better and better. We have a fighting chance. You never know. Now we kind of know. We kind of know where these games are going, at least so far, before we've gotten there. But really, this season was coming down to how decent a record were we going to have without actually contending? Probably. Now it just feels like the record is immaterial, which is a hard thing to explain to my sister, who would only, again, assumes, don't you want your team to win every night? And probably hard to explain to your brother or your brother understands it, but to not really want to buy in. And I know a lot of Mets fans right now aren't thrilled because if you are a fan, you do spend every day with your team. Those who don't spend every day with your team aren't listening to a show like this or reading anything I write. I understand that. That's, you know what? When you start winning, you bring in those people, and that's great. And they'll be back when that time comes, hopefully. But in the interim, it's a tough watch now that we use certain verbs as nouns.
We put on the games and we want the Mets to do well. And then in the back of our heads, we're thinking, well, if they finish in the bottom nine, then they're in the draft lottery. And then if they're in the draft lottery, they can get one of the top six picks, which might be the top five pick. I don't want to think about that. I don't want to think about that. I want the Mets to win. And their chances of win are lessened. And I get it. And we're being pragmatic, we're being mature, but it's tough watching some of these games. It's tough watching some of these players. On Saturday, we saw Danny Mendick pinch hit for DJ Stewart. And that's a sentence I never want to say again, except in spring training. And Mendick, with the Mets down three runs, swung at the first pitch and popped out. You're Danny Mendick. Try and work out a walk. You're leading off an inning. Try and work out a walk. Maybe this pitcher is no good. Try and feel him out. But he swung at the first pitch, and I said, oh, I can't take this. So it's frustrating for all of us, whether we just want to be entertained or we want the Mets to win. because we expected a certain level of this at this season, and we didn't get it. And that led to Steve and Alex's email to all of the season ticket holders, sort of apologizing. And one of the things he said in there, one of the things they both said, because it was signed by both of them, was that he said, well, we can watch these entertaining youngsters. They're not all entertaining. And that's frustrating because Brett Beatty, for example, is getting me concerned about next year. As of this moment, let me check the stats. Brett Beatty has struck out 35 times in his last 30 at bats, and he's not fielding well. And then you put Vientos there, and he's not fielding well. And Buck doesn't play Vientos as much as he should have. So he's still feeling his way in the majors. And I'm getting worried about that. But it's certainly, no matter how what your perspective is, it's certainly not a fun watch. And we expected that. And we have 2 months of this left.
Yeah, and we can vote with our eyes, I suppose, and look away. Of course, you and I aren't going to because we're Mets fans and we're into this. Listen, the expectations game was dashed by June when this team lost most of the games it played that month and wasn't doing all that well beforehand. So as far as a Beatty or a Vientos having growing pains, this is what we asked for. And, we being fan sentiment in general, we always want to see whoever Beatty or Vientos or Alvarez is in a given moment when things aren't going fantastic with whoever's already there. So, the best you can say about Beatty struggling right now is it kind of doesn't matter. And it'll add up in his statistics and it will not contribute to Met wins probably. And it won't be pleasant to watch. But, when we were signing on for bring up Brett Beatty and not burning season tickets in the parking lot over the trade of Eduardo Escobar, which was, sort of a precursor to everything else that happened trade-wise, there was no guarantee that Brett Beatty was going to come right out of the chute and be David Wright 2.0 or even a fairly accurate impression of Eduardo Escobar. Wasn't having a great year by any means, but kind of knew what he was doing. This is the learning curve. This is the year it takes place. Vientos farther behind that because he hasn't really played much. And if we get to Ronnie Mauricio, it'll be something like that. It just always is. It was like that for a few weeks with Alvarez, who we all embrace now and is who Cone was probably talking about when he's going on about those exciting young players. Just for the record, I don't think about draft choices at all, draft selection at all. I know some people are very into that. I understand that, there's the luxury tax penalty is somehow lessened if we're really bad and we get to pick higher or whatever the hell it is. You know what? They'll pick where they pick and they'll pick who they pick, and I'll get excited when the time comes. Again, I've lived through so many Augusts like this and so many years like this, which might speak to perhaps a need to be more discerning about what I do with my living because this is what I live with. This is part of being a fan. I'm not going to say it's part of being a Mets fan. It's part of being a fan. If you are committed to your team and you're not looking for a way out or you're not the type to just say, it doesn't matter to me that much, and you wash your hands of the whole thing. You're going to get an August like this now and then. It might calibrate depending on the team you root for. Some teams don't seem to have as many Augusts like this, but there are years where teams are just kind of not in it. So, I think what it's come down to is the strange sensation of being all in on being all out, and the mess. Are all in on being all out. And if that means Danny Mendick and DJ Stewart and Rafael Ortega and the guy who was here last week, Jonathan Arroyos, all of whom are getting a chance, none of whom are getting us excited. That doesn't speak great for the momentary depth of the organization. I don't think any of us, give or take, a sighting in spring training, but Stewart was the guy who had the cycle, I believe, in spring training. Mendick, I remember reading articles when they signed him about what a coup this was, because we were getting a solid utility man that we could stash in Syracuse while he continued to recover from, I think it was ACL surgery. And he's a real good major leaguer. And aren't we lucky that we have a team that can go out and get Danny Mendick? Well, Danny Mendick showed up and he's Danny Mendick. And I don't want to, put that down. He's in the major leagues and he's been in the major leagues with other teams, as has Stewart and Arraez and Ortega. We just didn't want to see him on our major league team this year playing this often. You kind of cycle through guys like this any year. It just feels like they are most of the team right now. Really, most of your lineups right now are one third quadruple A players, one third rookies, for better or worse, and one third, maybe more than one third of everybody's healthy, guys who should be doing better. The core of the team is still here on an everyday basis. I mean, they traded two top flight pitchers, whatever their progress was as Mets, and a bunch of complimentary players. But you still have the Alonzos, McNeils, Nimmos, Martes, and Lindors. And there is this notion of they were just so shocked by what happened that as soon as David Robertson was traded, everybody just felt so abandoned. And it's like, I don't want to hear that. That bothers me more than having to watch DJ Stewart or Danny Mendick or any of these guys. And, some of them are kind of coming out of it now. But it felt like, they didn't know what to do with themselves. And maybe I'm reading too much into it. But you know what? On any given night, three to five of those guys are in the lineup. And, this isn't, to me, a few weeks ago when we were talking about the 1993 Mets and stepping back and looking at all those accomplished players who didn't come through. These are accomplished players in their prime. Some of those guys were just sort of, on the downside. This is Lindor 1 year removed from an MVP contending season. Alonso, same thing. McNeil won a batting title last year, as we've talked about. Marte got MVP votes. We've been thrilled about Nimmo to have him back for, and the way he was playing last year, a year and a half. These guys, I hate to talk in very basic terms. These guys kind of have to step up. And I don't know what that means exactly. Maybe they're stepping up too much, which is to say, maybe they're trying in their own way too hard, swinging too much at pitches that don't need to be swung at, whatever it is. But here's your chance. These are all veterans now, not over the hill veterans, but guys in their prime. This is time to step up, take the younger guys under your wing, take the quadruple A guys and show them the way to be. And this is on everybody. It's on the manager, it's on the coaches, it's on the general manager, whatever impact him and his staff have at this point on what's on the field. So, everybody, this boy, but I think I've settled it. Play better. Really is.
You mentioned 1977. A big difference between then and now is that at that time, management was getting rid of a player that they thought was the enemy and they were shedding salary. Here, they don't care about shedding salary. They weren't doing it for that reason. There was strategy involved. So, again, we're being pragmatic and it's frustrating, but at least there's a plan.
It feels like there's a plan, and I'm sure there is a plan. I guess if we come back in 3 years and we say, wow, those guys we got didn't really add up to very much. But what a process. Now, wasn't that a great process? What were you saying before about no banners for best minor league system? There's no banners for what a process. And right now we kind of have to be in love with the process. And if it works out retroactively, we'll put up all the banners in the world and say, wasn't that great? Look where we are now. Again, I think this is tougher coming off of last year than it would be just if 2023 had followed 2021. Let's pretend for just a moment that 2022 never happened. The 101 wins, the trip to the playoffs, the year in first place mostly. And we were just going from team that, if you can think back that far, a team that had been in first place much of 2021, never looked that great, and then kind of fell apart and ended up under 500. And you took that team apart and did this. It would feel like a lot more, I don't know if logical is the word, but it would feel like it would be following in something. The fact that we fell so far all at once, this season, barring a miracle, and I wouldn't want to waste a miracle on this, but barring a miracle, This is going to be the worst year-over-year record drop. I don't mean needle drop, record drop in franchise history. Going from however 101 wins to, listen, if it's like 75 wins, I'm pretty sure it will be the worst, 26 minus. So we're already kind of there, and it's tougher to take. If we were coming off a 77 and 85 season, just being 71 and 91 this year, we wouldn't blink probably. But that's what we're looking at because when your brother mentioned entertaining, last year was entertaining as hell. So it's very stark right now, and we have to have, well, again, if we want to have faith, we got to have faith. Let's put it that way.
And one thing that this season does, it makes last season's failure in the playoffs more frustrating. Because what I said at the end of last season was, I can only deal with the loss to San Diego in terms of it being a stepping stone. And it certainly has not been. So it certainly was not a stepping stone to this year, which makes me now, and I think you've done the same thing, replay some of the games, some of the decisions from last year. And I had put all that in the rearview mirror.
Yeah, I had kind of made my peace as best I could with how last year wound up, mostly in terms of September. Less so the playoffs is, two out of three games. What are you going to do? My big regret, if I'm going to have one, is that we didn't win the division title. Not because it would have set us up so much better with the bye and whatever would have happened. Just I wanted a division title. We were in first place for however many days. We were at this time last year about six or seven games ahead of the Braves, and then it began to melt away. And we didn't, we played aesthetically badly, but our record really wasn't that bad as the year went on. It was just the Braves just blew by us, and then it boiled down to those three games in Atlanta, and we know what happened. But again, it did reset, here's that word again, expectations. And even if every year is different from the year before and different from the year after, you're going to have expectations based on what you last saw, unless you completely tear it down, which the Mets didn't. This was not a 97 to 98 Marlins, to use that example again. And that's what made the season frustrating before late July, that we had so many of those guys still here. And now it's kind of the ghost that hovers over 2023. I guess in a way it makes me appreciate last year more, and we probably should appreciate the 101 wins and the 5.5 months first place. I know that sounds kind of Pollyannish considering how it ended up, but as we probably said before, you don't get too many. We know, hey, guess what? You don't get too many seasons like that. It was a lot of fun while it was going on. And it, in a way, as we went through September, it felt a little ungrateful to be so nervous about them not having clinched, but they didn't. And we're fans. We will not take losses in good humor, no matter what season they're coming in. So no, it's not 1977 per se, but when you're getting swept on an entire road trip, and you've got a bunch of players who you weren't expecting to constitute your lineup, and got a bunch of guys getting off the bus and coming in the sixth inning to pitch, it's hard not to make the comparisons and make you feel even worse.
Now, before, Greg, you mentioned what if they had just traded the guys on the expiring contract but kept Scherzer and Verlander? Is there a parallel universe, a parallel reality, a sliding doors? Shout out to Gwyneth Paltrow, who I'm sure watches, listens to the show. To you, what do you think might have happened?
I'm sure Gwyneth Paltrow watches the show because I'm sure she has her own feed. What might have happened or what would have happened, God only knows. But listen, 50 years ago, when free agency wasn't a thing, God knows contracts like those that Scherzer and Verlander had wasn't a thing, and God knows Met management that paid off contracts wasn't a thing. A chairman of the board wandered into the clubhouse concerned that the Mets were not playing well and gave them a pep talk. And one of the relief pitchers got all excited and shouted, "You gotta believe." And they took off from there. Is it so hard to imagine Steve Cohen say that game against the Nationals, the first game when there was the rain delay and David Robertson had been up in the pen? And then when they come out of the rain delay, Robertson isn't pitching, and we're all a little confused. And it turned out they traded David Robertson, and the sale is on. What happens if instead of all that, during that rain delay, Steve Cohen and Alex Cohen maybe come into the clubhouse, take a cue from, dare I say, him, Donald Grant, say, "We want you to know that we believe in you boys, and we're not making any moves because you're our guys, you're our team. You got us so close last year. We know you're good. You've got our faith. Go get them when the tarp comes off." Well, I'd like to imagine David Robertson, up down notwithstanding, goes out there, warms up, takes care of the Nationals. They win as they did in extra innings. Cannon and Pham are still here because you're not looking at DJ Stewart, Rafael Ortega in the outfield. So if Nimmo needs a few days and Marte was still getting over his migraines, you've got a really solid outfield. You have Robertson coming in and not Josh Walker, bases loaded, balk before throwing a pitch to lose a game. And you have Verlander and Scherzer. Verlander definitely on the upswing. Scherzer, allowing for a few home runs, but you don't have David Peterson. You don't have Tyler McGill taking those starts. And it's a team together. Ownership is confident and there's faith and maybe there's a little fire. And you know what? The last six games that they played under those conditions, it's a very good chance the Mets went 2-4. Instead of 0-6, maybe they go 3-3. In our wildest dreams, they went 6-0 and are doing what the Cubs have done, which has been on fire since before the trade deadline. And they were worse than the Mets a couple of weeks ago. Or you're being like the Padres and like hanging in there just a few games out and having gotten some reinforcements for a possible wild card run. It's possible all of that could have happened, but then again, you step back and say, where was this team that we are now imbuing magic powers with while they had the chance to do this? The one guy who has come out of this, I think, looking better than anybody is Jose Quintana, who I feel not exactly bad for because I'm sure he's got a pretty nice contract. Remember Jose Quintana signing with the Mets last December, and it wasn't all that exciting compared to signing Senga and signing Verlander and everything else that was going on. But here's Quintana. He's an experienced pitcher, former All-Star. He's going to be a big help. And then he unfortunately has an injury and he's missing a few months. And he's like, "Okay, guys, I'm ready. Where is this contender I signed up to play for? I'm ready to help the Mets make the playoffs." And it's like, we got bad news, Jose. That team barely exists. Oh, wait a second. Now it doesn't exist anymore. But could you go out there and pitch every 5 days anyway? And he's pitched great. This is a guy who, if we, that cliche, it'll be, the injured player who you're not going to see until the All-Star break. It'll be like trading for a Jose Quintana. Well, we kind of did that, and he's done his part. He hasn't won a game because the Mets have not supported him. It's sort of a rites of initiation with some Met pitchers that they don't win a game no matter how well they pitch. And he pitched great ending the weekend in Baltimore, and that was something to watch when he pitched and he did not allow runs, or at least the runs were not on him. I was entertained. Sometimes you go to a game and you just, hope to be entertained. I hope you've been entertained when you went most recently.
I went on Saturday, and Greg, you mentioned staying alive before. There was certainly no night fever for Mets fans at Camden Yards on Saturday. The Camden Yards was beautiful as always. It was packed because it was 1983 World Champions Reunion night, which I didn't know. It was also a seven line night, as you might have seen on TV. I was sitting with my son in the section next to the seven line. They were surprisingly quiet, surprisingly only because seven line is always loud, but here the even their struck him outs didn't have the same fervor, and I don't blame them. It was a long night, another 3 hour game and a frustrating night, but Camden Yards is always beautiful. I will note that my son, who's a beer aficionado, said that the Camden Yards beer selection is not as good as the one in the ballpark in Washington. But he did have a Eddie Murray IPA, And on the 1983 World Champion Orioles, we saw two ex-Mets, of course, Eddie Murray, and also Ken Singleton. But it was a long, frustrating game. And despite my feelings, I'm not going to care. I would just want to enjoy the evening with my son. It was my son's first time at Camden Yards in years. His first baseball game was at Camden Yards. And that was the first baseball game at Camden Yards. The Mets played in the first baseball game at Camden Yards, an exhibition game before the official first opener. The Mets played the Orioles. Sid Fernandez pitched. And I even found my notes for that game. Vince Coleman bunted for a single on the first pitch of the game. But it was nice to sit with my son. He laughed. He's in his 30s, but he had never heard a certain baseball term. And the Orioles closer was up when they had a 3-run lead, and he was throwing at full throttle. And then when they had a 4-run lead, they brought in somebody else. And I said to my son, well, they didn't want to use him in a non-safe situation, but that means they dry humped him. And he had never heard that phrase, dry hump, in a baseball context. And he thought that was very funny. And so I enjoyed that moment. But there was one time, Greg, after Nimmo tried to stretch a single into a double down 3 runs. And I had such a bad reaction to that. I hung my head, and a guy next to me wearing a 7-line shirt just said 2025. And I said, we can hope.
We can hope to be staying alive, and we can stop asking Buck Showalter, whoever's managing the Mets by then, how deep is your bench? Because right now, the depth isn't there. Well, I'm glad you and Eric had a great time. Listen, Camden Yards is still, after 30 plus years, one of the beauties on the baseball map. And I would imagine that the Eddie Murray IPA is guaranteed to put a scowl on your face. But that's one thing we have over the Orioles, in addition to 1969, is we haven't been waiting as long as them for a another world championship. But I think once you get past a certain amount of years lording over a team that's waited 40 years because we've only waited 37 years, does not really apply. I'm glad you had a good time. I'm going to be at a game this week. Went to a couple of games in July before the entire season was so obviously over with. I went out of my way. It was July 21st. It was Jose Quintana's first, excuse me, July 20th. Jose Quintana's first start as a Met. That was not really the occasion I was setting out for. That was my 50th anniversary game. I decided to throw a celebration for myself. 50 years earlier, July 11th, 1973, was my first game at Shea Stadium. Like Eric, I can remember the occasion. And they were having an all-star break this year when we hit 50. So I picked out an afternoon game against the White Sox. Surrounded myself. I didn't necessarily mean to. But as it turned out, I was sitting in a section full of day campers, which was perfect because my first game was as a day camper. A camp group took us on a bus, and we learned what Shea Stadium was in person. Not that I didn't know what it was from watching on TV for several years, but my tale of woe is that nobody took me to a game as soon as I learned what baseball was as a kid, and I had to wait till I was an old man of 10 before going, and I wanted to commemorate it. So, I went. It was one of those games where I really didn't care what happened and then would have liked to win, I suppose, but it was so obvious the Mets were going to lose that day to the crummy White Sox. I mean, Quintana pitched okay, but he was still working off the rust and nobody really hit. I think Omar Narvaez hit a home. Did he hit a home run that day? Yes, he did. I enjoyed that because a little girl from the day camp sitting behind me was aware enough to realize Francisco Alvarez wasn't catching. And when Omar Narvaez came up, she said, "Who's that?" And Narvaez hits a home run. I thought to myself, well, now you know who Omar Narvaez is. And you and I, my dear, we have this memory. I don't know if she remembers it anymore, but I will. And it was just a beautiful, sunny, hot day. And I strolled around the ballpark, went down those ramps that are a poor substitute for the Shea Stadium ramps, but the ones that attach to the left field side of the ballpark, and just had a really good time. 9 days later, I was back for what turned out to be Justin Verlander's final start. And you know what? I would love to tell you, I was just like zeroed in on watching the brilliance of Verlander as he did upend the Nationals. But you know what? You go to a game sometimes and you just wind up talking to your friend. You know, I didn't go to this one by myself. We just chatted away for 9 innings. One of the things we talked about were all the great pitchers we had seen in our lives. My friend's a bit older than I am, so you know, he goes back to seeing Billy Pierce, a pitcher for the White Sox in 1959 at Yankee Stadium, that sort of thing, and remembered seeing Warren Spahn pitch for the Mets. And you know, we enjoyed going down those rabbit holes. And oh, they've just took Verlander out of the game, and we're sort of applauding. And I'm thinking this might be his last start, but as a Met, but that seems unlikely. And then after the game, he said, "Wow, I'll never forget that ovation I got, no matter what happens." Like, oh, I guess it was his last start. So these are the sorts of games that, as this season goes along, that if you're not committed to this team, or you haven't already bought tickets, you're not going to seek out. But for fans who just can't stop ourselves, there are joys to be had. So glad I had those days. Glad you had that night in Baltimore. And I hope the Mets can entertain us a little better than they have.
Moving on, Eddie Brasseau passed away in July at the age of 91. He was an all-star for the Red Sox in 1964, a member of the world champion Cardinals in 1967, and a New York Met in 1966. And anyone that wore a Mets uniform is worth remembering.
Yeah, today we remember Eddie Brasseau, who passed away during the all-star break. Eddie Brasseau might not be a familiar name if you've come along in the last 50 years to Mets baseball, and I will be the first to admit I never saw him play, but I've been aware of him for a long time, doing my reading as a kid and coming across this fact. The Mets shortstop who hit the most home runs in a single season was Eddie Brasseau, which was a name that was news to me when I learned it circa 1975, because it had happened in 1966. This was a record that had some legs. Eddie Brasseau, 10 home runs, primarily a shortstop. He hit a couple playing another position, but that was his main job, was to be the Mets starting shortstop in that year. 10 home runs, which may not sound like a ton in the modern era, but you got to remember, this is the 1960s where defense mattered most with shortstops, and they weren't hiring power hitters, but he had some pop. And that record stayed in place and wasn't approached for more than 20 years. Kevin Elster had to come along and hit 10 home runs circa 1989 to tie it. And it wasn't broken until Jose Reyes, 2006, hit 19 home runs and then would top that, I think. And even if he didn't top it, Francisco Lindor would. Struble Cabrera did too. What I'm saying here is that Eddie Brasseau was ahead of his time as an offensive shortstop. And Eddie Brasseau had a few other distinctions. Eddie Brasseau was a New York Giant, was until last month one of the last living New York Giants. There are only nine now. Brasseau had made it 10 for all these years. He came up in 1956, played for them a couple of years, went to San Francisco, continued to play for them as a teammate of the only other New York Giant to play as a New York Met, Willie Mays. Obviously, we know Willie Mays didn't come along to the Mets until later. I'm sure if Joan Payson, a New York Giants fan, had had her way, Willie Mays would have been acquired in 1962. So while the Mets had a lot of Brooklyn Dodgers and a lot of that DNA obvious for the many abandoned Brooklyn Dodger fans who would become Mets fans, Brasseau was our first Giant, New York Giant. And we will also mention that Eddie Brasseau had had some success after leaving the Giants and before coming to the Mets as a Boston Red Sox, was an all-star at Shea Stadium, didn't get into the game, but was selected to represent the Red Sox in the 64 All-Star game. Maybe took a look around at Shea Stadium and said, boy, I'd sure like to play here someday. What a nice new stadium. Which brings to mind another distinction of Eddie Brasseau. You might not think it would be such a small club, but it adds up to two people. You think about the classic New York ballparks of the 20th century. And with all due respect to Washington Park in Brooklyn and Hilltop Park in Manhattan, I'm talking about, yes, Yankee Stadium, the original, and the Polo Grounds, our original, Ebbets Field, on which City Field is based, and of course, our beloved Shea Stadium. Do you know how many Mets can claim the following? A base hit in the regular season in all four of those ballparks. A base hit playing in a game that counted in the regular season. Ebbets Field, the Polo Ground, Shea Stadium, Yankee Stadium. Exactly two, one of whom is still with us, Felix Mantilla, an original Met, one of whom was Eddie Brasseau. The reason I think it's such a small cohort is you didn't have that many players switching leagues in those days. There was no free agency, and trades between the leagues were sort of frowned upon by the leagues. There was a lot more competition between the leagues in those days, and you were more likely to trade within your league. They even had special deadlines that said, okay, that's it. You can no longer have interleague trades. And of course, no interleague games. So you weren't just going to suddenly be playing a game in Kansas City or Baltimore if you were a New York Met. So, I think this sort of indicates that Eddie Brasseau was wanted in a few different places and that he lasted because to have played in Ebbets Field, you had to have been in the major leagues by 1957 in the National League and gotten enough at bats if you weren't a Dodger to have spent time in a lineup. So he's already in the Polo Grounds as a New York Giant, and he would not be in the Polo Grounds as a Met, as some or in a Met game, which makes his distinction here a little unusual because you think about a guy like, say, Pete Rose. He played in the Polo Grounds, but not against the Giants, guys who came along later. So by the time the Mets exist, you're already kind of running out of guys who would have played way back when there was an Ebbets Field. And those guys wouldn't last long enough to see Shea Stadium, and they might not have played in the American League. And again, I'm putting aside guys who played in the World Series, like Duke Snider and Willie Mays, because those are special occasions. So those are just a few things that make Eddie Brasseau's career noteworthy. More importantly, Eddie Brasseau, by all accounts, a wonderful man. He finished in baseball as a player, 67, a world champion St. Louis Cardinal, and he had put in a dozen seasons at that point, four different clubs, won admirers all over the place, did some scouting, worked in front offices, but ultimately was a baseball coach in California. His players swore by him. And to this day, and when I say to this day, in the modern era, we are blessed to have something called the Ultimate Mets Database, which has not only lots of facts and figures, but has a section for what are called fan memories, where people just show up and will tell you what they remember about a certain Met from a certain time. It's always entertaining because you often get, relatives of those people who are happy to see these names show up online, or you will get somebody who was a fan of a player when he wasn't a Met, and he'll suddenly remember, oh, I remember when so and so played for the Pirates. What a nice guy! And sometimes you'll get just some random rant about this terrible game somebody had in 1978 or whatever. I had looked up Eddie Brasseau's fan memories page in Ultimate Mets database, and this was typical. I'm just going to give you what somebody remembers. And remember, Eddie Brasseau was a Met for exactly 1 year, 1966. He's kind of a seat filler. Roy McMillan had been the trusty, dependable veteran shortstop for a couple of years, and he was mentoring Bud Harrelson. Bud Harrelson was a skinny kid who was not going to hit 10 home runs in 1 year as a shortstop, by the way. And in between, they needed somebody to kind of move the process along because Roy McMillan was ready to move along by 66. And that's how you got Eddie Brasseau. And by the way, Eddie Brasseau's 1 year, let's not gloss over 1966. 1966 is the year the Mets finish out of last place for the first time. 1966 is the year the Mets lose fewer than 100 games. These are milestones not to be taken lightly in 1966. Let's hope, but we're not congratulating the 2023 Mets on not finishing in 10th place this year or losing 100 games. But this was one of the memories. And I think it speaks volumes about, what a player can be as a person and what a fan can feel. And again, this is somebody who saw him in 66. Eddie drives up to the players' parking lot behind the Met bullpen. Kids would hang there early and scream for tickets as the players pulled up. Eddie reaches out with two tickets and says, "Don't sell these. I'll be watching for you." My friend and I go inside, and we were right behind the Met dugout, three rows back. Eddie starts that day, and first time up, he looks back to see if we're there. We wave and yell, "Hit a homer, Eddie!" Of course he does, and we go nuts. He comes back to the dugout, looks at us, and smiles. For two 15-year-old kids, it made our decade. Think about that. This is the decade of the 1960s. This is the decade of 1969. But these guys were okay with, you know, once you had Eddie Brasseau hit a home run for you after giving you tickets. Everything else is gravy. So, you know, 1 year as a Met certainly left an impact and might not have resonated down the halls of time because, you know, again, his one record was broken. The distinctions I mentioned are, you know, sort of esoteric. I will be the first to admit that. But you know what? For 1 year, you were a Mets fan. You looked forward to Eddie Brasseau's at bats. Maybe he didn't give you a ticket, but he probably hit a home run for you at some point. Because he had more home runs than any shortstop did as a Met for a long time. So always followed word of what Eddie Brasseau was up to in the years that followed. And, you know, again, he lived to be 91, so you can't say he was cheated. Sorry to hear of his passing, though. Sorry for his family. And, you know, as we say about all these guys, you know, thank you for your service. Thank you for being a New York Met, Eddie Brasseau.
Beautiful words, Greg. Our condolences to the family and friends of Eddie Brasseau. Before we go, we received a review from Mondo Dave. Mondo Dave reviewed the show and wrote, "I've been listening since the very first episode and have never missed one. Greg and Jeff started out great and continue to get better. I subscribe to a lot of Mets podcasts, and this is the only one I listen to regularly. It is head and shoulders above the others. You can tell these guys bleed orange and blue, and they are the kind of fans to whom I can relate." Very, very, very nice. Thank you, Mondo Dave.
Dave, you are Mondo. Thank you very much.
And we encourage you to follow and like and review the show. It helps us gain traction in a very crowded field of Mets podcasts. And we thank you for listening to this episode of National League Town. We'll be back next week as Greg takes us back to 2003. And a shout out to listener Steve J. Rogers, who wrote that he is already prepping for that show. We don't assign homework, but Steve J. Rogers is doing some homework in preparation for Greg's discussion of 2003. So until then, I'm Jeff Heisen.
For the first time in my life, I'm looking forward to the 2003 Mets. I'm Greg Prince.
And as always, let's go Mets! Copyright 2023, music provided by the Royal Arctic Institute. Their latest album, From Coma to Catharsis, is now available on vinyl. For more information and tour dates, check them out on Bandcamp.